This ASMEA podcast discussion, Noncompliance, International Law in the Middle East, was recorded during the 5th Annual Conference of the Association for the Study of the Middle East and Africa in Washington, D.C. on October 12, 2012.
Welcome to the panel titled Noncompliance, International Law in the Middle East. I'm Ord Khitri, serving as both the moderator and a panelist today. I'll start by briefly introducing the panelists. We'll then each make presentations for about 10 minutes, then we'll open it up to questions from you. I'll go in alphabetical order, starting with Avi Bell. Avi is a professor at the San Diego University School of Law. He'll be speaking on the topic, the application of the laws of war in the Arab states. Professor Bell has taught courses and topics including the laws of war and also legal aspects of the Arab-Israeli conflict. His scholarship focuses on property, international law, and economic analysis of the law. Prior to becoming a law professor, Bell clerked for Justice Michael Sheshen of the Supreme Court of Israel and for the High Court of Justice, a department within the Israeli State Attorney's Office. One of his most recent publications is titled, quote, A Critique of the Goldstone Report and Its Treatment of International Humanitarian Law. After that, Dr. Alan Gerson will be speaking on the topic of the rule of law in the conduct of U.S. foreign affairs, with a special emphasis on the Middle East. Dr. Gerson is recognized as the first attorney to engineer a practical basis for suing foreign governments for acts of terrorism. After the 1988 bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, Dr. Gerson initiated the first civil suit against a foreign state, Libya, on behalf of families of the victims. In 1996, Dr. Gerson's efforts were instrumental in the passage of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which provides U.S. citizens with the right to sue foreign governments in U.S. courts for complicity in terrorism. The outcome of Dr. Gerson's efforts, in conjunction with other attorneys, was a historic $2.7 billion settlement with Libya. Earlier in his career, Dr. Gerson served in positions including Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Legal Counsel and Counsel for International Affairs with the U.S. Department of Justice, and as Senior Counsel to two U.S. ambassadors to the United Nations. It's also worth noting, in light of today's panel topic, that Dr. Gerson is the author of a book titled Israel, the West Bank, and International Law, an examination of the legal and political aspects of Israel's military administration of the West Bank prior to the Oslo Accords. Ord Khitri, that's me, is a professor of law at Arizona State University. I'll be speaking on the topic Iran's Ayatollahs and international law. Prior to entering academia, I served for 11 years in various legal and policy positions at the U.S. State Department, including as director of international anti-crime programs and as lead attorney for nuclear affairs. Eugene Kantorovich, down at the end, is a professor at the Northwestern University School of Law. He'll be speaking on the topic, the legal status of settlements, Western Sahara, Cyprus, and the West Bank. Professor Kantorovich's research spans the fields of constitutional law, international law, and law and economics. In the international law arena, Professor Kantorovich is a leading expert on maritime piracy, universal jurisdiction, and international criminal law. His scholarship has been relied on in important foreign relations cases in the federal courts and historic piracy cases in the U.S. and abroad. He's also written and lectured extensively about the legal aspects of the Israel-Arab conflict. This should be an interesting panel. So much of the discussion in international legal circles is usually about Israel's compliance with international law. The Goldstone Report on the legality of Israel's actions during the 2009 Gaza War, the question of the legality of Israeli settlements, the question of the legality of Israeli actions vis-a-vis the Gaza flotilla have all been the topic of entire conferences, let alone panels. This will be the first time, to my knowledge, that even one panel has focused on surveying the international law compliance record of the other 20 or so countries in the Middle East. Congratulations to David and to ASMEA for pulling this together. With that, I'll turn to Avi for his presentation.
Thank you very much. What I wanted to talk about in the laws of war is as follows. It's generally, the general misconception is that there is very little to international laws of terrorism. I'll just give you a typical quote. Amnesty International report from July 2002. Amnesty International does not use the term terrorism because it does not have an internationally agreed definition, and in practice is used to describe quite different forms of conduct. And I think that describes a general attitude of a number of NGOs and advocacy organizations. They tend to view terrorism as a political rather than a legal issue. Now, as it turns out, there is quite a great deal of international law having to do with terrorism. Some of it is international law that's generalized, that doesn't involve the term terrorism, but forbids a number of acts that we would consider to be terrorism. So there are treaties on, for example, airline hijacking. That's forbidden under international law. States are required to do various things to prevent it. There's a variety of forms of international law that forbid attacks on civilians, not just in armed conflict. And again, this is something that terrorist groups do. We won't find in the generalized law necessarily the term terrorism attached to these acts, but there certainly is a great deal of international law forbidding the acts. Now, in addition, there's also international law that specifically requires states to act against terrorism. And so what you'll see in a number of the reports of international organizations, for example, when you look at, there's a Human Rights Watch report from 2003, in the name of counterterrorism, human rights abuses worldwide, the primary interest of these groups when they talk about international law and terrorism is to block what they view as abuses committed in fighting terrorism. What you won't see acknowledged is that international law, in a variety of ways, requires states, requires them to take action against terrorism. Now, there's three different kinds of laws that require taking action against terrorism. You have treaties, you have customary law, and you have some Security Council resolutions. I don't believe that I have time to go through all of these. What I'm going to jump to is I'm going to look at them selectively by looking at two things. First of all, the way the Arab League states in general reacted to the development of this law, and second of all, by looking at how they failed to comply with it. Let's start with this, and this is not per se an Arab League issue. This is actually a larger issue of the Muslim world. There's, in the development of the law against terrorism, or in the development of the law requiring states to take enforcement measures against terrorism, there's been an attempt from Muslim countries to create a legal exception for certain kinds of terrorism. You can call this, or it's generally called the freedom fighter exception, and the idea is that states should not be required to enforce the laws of war and should not be required to take enforcement action when the terrorism is committed in service of the self-determination struggle of a people against foreign occupation. And in those cases, presumably, all bets are off, anything can be done. Now, interestingly, they've had very, very little success, actually, in influencing the international law of terrorism. So let's start with the treaties. There is a large number of treaties having to do with requiring the enforcement, state enforcement against terrorism. We'll take the two general treaties. There's the International Convention for the Suppression of Terrorist Bombings from 1997 and the International Convention for the Suppression of Financing of Terrorism from 1999. 15 of the 21 Arab League states are members of the Bombing Convention. 16 of the 21 are members of the Financing Convention. I'm excluding from this the Palestinians because their treaty-making capacity is, let's say, controversial. So we'll count 21 rather than 22 members of the Arab League. At any rate, this is not as large a percentage as you will see in the rest of the world. Roughly 75 to 80% of the world are members of the the bombing and financing conventions, but still, this is quite a large number. When it comes to the bombing convention, Pakistan added a reservation when it joined the treaty to the effect that it would not apply to the freedom fighter exception. None of the Arab states that joined the treaty added such a reservation. I should add, of course, that numerous states argued that such a reservation would not be effective anyway, as it is contrary to the purposes of the treaty. When it comes to the financing convention, the only states that added such a reservation in the Arab League were Egypt and Jordan. It's an interesting two set of states. But again, most of them did not add such a reservation. Again, all the states, not all the other states, but a large number of other states objected that such reservations would in any way be ineffective. I should add that the bombing treaty actually has a clause saying there is no freedom fighter exception, or that none of these acts shall be justifiable for reasons of politics, et cetera, meaning that Egypt's reservation in the financing treaty is apparently inconsistent with its having joined the bombing treaty. Now, that's on treaties. There are a variety of Security Council resolutions that were introduced after 9/11 that are under Chapter 7 and therefore binding on all states. Now, there's a question of whether they can actually do this kind of legislative activity, but let's just, the bottom line is they require enforcement action against terrorist groups, they require denying safe haven, they require a whole variety of actions and theoretically are binding on every single state that is a member of the United Nations. You have also an interesting development. Recently, there's a special tribunal in Lebanon that's judging the killing of Hariri, issued a judgment, issued a ruling, let's say, on the applicable rules in which it said that we've clearly come to the point where there's a customary law requiring enforcement action against the international crime of terrorism. And of course, if there is such a custom, then it would apply to all against persistent objectors. Now, there's even, by the way, an Arab Convention Against Terrorism from 1998, I believe. Of course, it does contain the freedom fighter exception in a very unique fashion. It also says that such actions, not only you may do such self-determined actions against foreign colonialism so long as it does not infringe upon the integrity of an Arab state, meaning that terrorism is okay if it's against Israel, but only if it doesn't bother an Arab state. So, for example, it's not permissible to do such actions if they bother Jordan or perhaps Lebanon. Right, now, what's the record of compliance of Arab states with all these various obligations? And now I've given myself about a minute to run through them. Basically, we can summarize this. I can summarize in 2 seconds. The record of compliance is terrible, right? So let's take an organization like Hamas. Is it an organization that has taken actions that can be classified as terrorism? Well, its actions can be classified as terrorism under the bombings convention, under the financing convention. Right? It clearly undertakes actions that are contrary to the laws of war that are considered in parlance to be terrorism. Hamas nevertheless operates openly in a number of Arab League states. It's Khaled Mashal moved from Jordan to Syria to Qatar and without any problems. He left Syria not because he was thrown out of there, but because there's some fighting going on there you might have heard about. Hezbollah has engaged again in all these actions forbidden under the bombing convention, financing convention. Lebanon nonetheless gives Hezbollah official status within its government. You can look at the Sabra and Shatila massacres, which were carried out by a fellow by the name of Eli Hobeika, who as a result of having carried them out was subsequently a minister in the Lebanese government. There's little question that the actions that he carried out were actions that we would consider to be terrorist and, in addition, violations of the laws of war, which require enforcement action against them, but they haven't taken place. The problem in all of this is that it's really not difficult at all to find examples of noncompliance. What the difficulty is in finding any record of compliance whatsoever. The one place where you can find the tiniest bit of compliance, it turns out that according to the WikiLeaks, we have records of the way the Arab states have responded to U.S. requests to block financing for Al-Qaeda. And it turns out that this is the one group where there's been partial compliance. Some states have complied with some U.S. requests regarding blocking financing, although here, too, the record is abysmal. And so we can go through organization after organization or state after state, and what we will find is the same thing. We have a vast body of law requiring actions against terrorism and almost no enforcement to match with that law. Thank you.
Thank you. Alan, or you prefer to sit? Okay.
Okay, good morning. First, I want to thank Professor Bell for an outstanding presentation, which has caused me to reconfigure some of the remarks that I was going to make, because I do want to respond to his discussion. Let me just give you a flavor of the kind of remarks I was going to make, and if I do have time, I'll get back to them. I was going to try to put international law and allegiance to international law in context, and I was going to begin by telling you a very curious fact, or a very curious episode, and it involves the President of the United States. On his way to address the United Nations General Assembly, and every president addresses the General Assembly session, he did something that no other president has done since the founding of the United Nations, which is he made zero mention about the UN Charter, zero mention about UN Charter principles, zero mention about international law, which is, of course, in marked contrast to the first speech that he gave before the United Nations, saying that his administration would stand for a reinvigorated multilateralist approach. This is not a critique. This is simply a description of facts. We haven't heard anything more on this from the Romney camp. In fact, they've expressed a much greater degree of contempt for the organization. But I want to get back to that political context later on. What I'd like to do now is tell you about two spheres in which the law operates in and in which I've been privileged to play a significant role. The first is on the public diplomacy level, and from 1981 to 1986, I was counsel to the U.S. delegation to the United Nations, and I dramatically witnessed the maneuvers that Dr. Bell referred to, which is every time we try to get a resolution passed which outlawed terrorism, which we could define in the simplest terms, you know, targeting women and children, et cetera, and non-combatants, not anything to do with the West Bank or occupied territories, but within a sovereign state itself. It was always subject to the following rider, which the Russians and the Chinese went along with, which is that insofar as there is activity against, this was the formula, alien, colonial or racist rule, it's necessarily not terrorism. And Israel fell conveniently. We finally, with the renunciation of the Zionism as racism resolution, were able to cut that out, but they still had to deal with alien and colonial rules. So I'm gratified to listen to his observations about the changes that have taken place a decade after I left the United Nations and the 1997 Bombing Convention and the 1999 Convention on Terrorist Financing. Which brings me to the second point, or the second sphere, and that is not public diplomacy, but what I have been engaged in for about the last, with an enormous frustration sometimes, 13 years, which is the application of international law in U.S. courts, how U.S. judges apply international law. And if you do that, you will see that it's not as clear as Professor Bell states. I would like it to be as clear, but unfortunately I can't say it's as clear, that the 97 and 99 conventions have definitively been accepted as binding international law. I would like that to be the case. And perhaps I can call on him as an expert witness to say that. But here's why I say that. I am involved as counsel to over 2,000 Israeli victims of Hamas suicide bombing attacks in what is called, mistakenly, Intifada II. Because Intifada II has nothing to do with an Intifada, which is what Intifada I was about, local insurrections. Intifada II was a war. It was a war that was waged with Saudi financing and Hamas fronts throughout Israel and the banking system on the West Bank led by the Arab Bank. At one point, there were more than 40 attacks a day. It was a war that was enormously effective against Israel and resulted in an enormous number of casualties. The families of the victims of the Hamas attacks approached me because they knew of the work that I had done with regard to holding Libya accountable for Pan Am 103, and then later on I had instituted a lawsuit with other attorneys against various Saudi banks, over 100 Saudi banks, for having helped finance or allowed money to flow freely to Al-Qaeda despite the strong objections of the U.S. administration. They did change their policies, but only after 9/11. So they said, well, what about us? You know, why don't we count? Why don't you represent, you know, us? And, you know, if you represent someone, the first thing you do is you try to find what's the applicable law. After all, the problem is that the act against Israeli victims of Hamas suicide bombings occurred abroad, and the perpetrators were abroad. All the facts were there. So there's only one statute, and it's called the Alien Tort Claims Act, and it was the subject of the U.S. Supreme Court, first in 2004 in the landmark Sosa case, trying to whittle it down and see where it applies. And the Supreme Court said that, look, the law was passed that the U.S. courts will have jurisdiction even though the crime was committed abroad, even though the victims are foreign. But only in the narrowest cases, in the most terrible, terrible cases. Sosa involved a DEA agent who was kidnapped and tortured for a day or two. He said, that's not enough. It has to be really terrible. So we went to court on behalf of the Israeli victims, and we said, Your Honor, you want to see something really terrible? What could be worse than genocide? And we're going to give you something that's even worse than genocide, genocidal terrorism. It's a term that we coined. And we said, if you take a look at Hamas and you take a look at its dedication, it's totally different than the PLO. It's dedicated to the destruction of an entity that is a member of the United Nations through the use of terrorism. And we gave a detailed brief to that effect. The judge, who has a similarity to my name, but otherwise no relationship, Judge Gershon, issued a very scholarly 78-page opinion in which she accepted the argument that indeed Hamas was involved in genocidal terrorism, at least as a prima facie case. We couldn't dismiss the case. At least there was a prima facie case to that effect, and that accordingly it fell within the strictures of the Supreme Court's ruling in Sosa case, and therefore the case would be heard and not dismissed, as the Arab Bank wanted to. We were holding the Arab Bank liable for damages because the Arab Bank essentially received sheets with about 100, well, maybe less, let's say several dozen names on them. They were all between the ages of 19 and, say, 23, and they were told to give each of these individuals $6,000 apiece from an account which was in Saudi Arabia. And we said, listen, any serious bank official would have realized that this is money being given to potential suicide bombers. At least they would have looked into it. And their failure to look into it was one contributing factor to the suicide bombings, and therefore they are liable in damages. That was our argument. And we were about to go to trial, And then this other case came out of the blue, which is the single most important case involving, I believe, international law and human rights in U.S. courts ever, the landmark case called Kyobo, which involves Shell and various plaintiffs who are trying to hold which are trying to hold Shell accountable, essentially, for having been party to certain practices in South Africa. The Supreme Court asked for re-argument. It was argued several weeks ago, and the issue was this. The issue is whether or not corporations can be held liable in U.S. courts for violation of customary international law. Conventional international law, which is treaties of the kind that Dr. Bell referred to, are supposed to be in a different category. The problem is that if you take a look at the way the Supreme Court questioned the presenters, especially Justice Alito, there were a lot of troubling incidents in which he really didn't distinguish between customary international law and conventional international law. He simply said, why should a foreign corporation be held liable in a U.S. court for acts that were committed abroad and where the victims were foreign? And the answer, of course, is because that's what the U.S. law says, but I'm not sure that the attorneys presented it in quite that way. So we are awaiting this Supreme Court decision, probably in, I would suppose, in the spring, and that will tell us a lot about what U.S. courts can do. I am hopeful that the Supreme Court will continue to draw a distinction between conventional international law and customary international law if it's going to exempt corporations from liability. I think that's a bad idea too, but at least don't exempt corporations from situations where they violate conventional international law. And then I would look to Dr. Bell's analysis to say that helping suicide bombers is a violation of, say, the Terrorist Financing Convention of 1999. How much time do I have left? All right. In my last minute, I would say this. I think it's unfortunate that for whatever reasons, intentionally or unintentionally, this administration, and I say this for Republicans and Democrats alike, have really stopped paying even lip service to compliance with international law, with honoring the dictates of UN Charter principles. It's in marked contrast to what other governments. The foreign minister of Russia said in very strong terms that Russia and, he said, China is going to look to UN Charter principles. The new president of Egypt said something similar. Cameron of the UK said that. But if you take a look, and if you take a look at the presidential or vice presidential debate last night, when both candidates are asked for criteria for intervention, they say, well, national security. Well, what's national security? They might have mentioned UN Charter principles. We were, after all, the principal draftsmen of the UN Charter. The United Nations is hosted here. And if you apply it, and if I have time, I will give you several instances in which application of UN Charter principles to the Israel-Iran situation, to the Palestinian-Israeli controversy, and I can go through the list, can at the very least provide justification, but I would argue even more than that, can be a factor guiding a wise decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. And now it's my turn to discuss the Iranian record with regard to international law. I'll provide an overview of the Iranian regime's record of noncompliance in the following areas of international law: diplomatic law, human rights law, nuclear nonproliferation law, state sponsorship of terrorism, and narcotics trafficking law. Then I'll briefly discuss some interesting characteristics of Iran's violations of international law, what we can expect from a nuclear Iran in light of this record, and I'll close with a brief discussion of U.S. policy options. But before I provide a sector-by-sector overview of Iran's record of noncompliance with international law, I thought it might be interesting to provide some context as to why Iran's record with regard to international law is as it is. There aren't a lot of quotes out there that I've been able to find from Iran's supreme leaders addressing international law compliance, but those that do exist are, I think, revealing. As you probably know, the Islamic Republic of Iran has had just two supreme leaders, the country's most powerful position, since the Iranian Revolution in 1979. The first was Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. When he died in 1989, he was replaced by Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Both of the quotes I've come across are about international human rights law. Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, leader of the Islamic Revolution and the first supreme leader, asserted that, quote, "What they call human rights is nothing but a collection of corrupt rules worked out by Zionists to destroy all true religions." Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the current supreme leader, stated, "When we want to find out what is right and what is wrong, we do not go to the United Nations. We go to the Holy Quran. For us, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is nothing but a collection of mumbo jumbo by disciples of Satan," said Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. I think Ayatollah Khamenei's juxtaposition of international law with the Quran is at the heart of the Iranian regime's attitude towards international law. And that isn't a comment on the Quran per se, it's a comment on the fact that Iran is a theocracy. Iran is a theocracy. Power is concentrated in the supreme leader in the Council of Guardians, positions that are unelected and religiously oriented. The theory behind this is velayat-e faqih, meaning rule by the jurisprudent, or rule of the Islamic jurist. Now, this concept is not without its opponents, both within Iran and within the Shiite religious establishment more broadly. But it is the fundamental ruling ethos of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Imam Khomeini was famously quoted as saying that, quote, "The will of the people must be second to the will of God." As a reflection of this attitude, Article 4 of the Iranian Constitution asserts that, quote, "All articles of the Constitution, as well as all other laws, must be based upon Islamic criteria." And who defines what Islam has to say? Well, it's the supreme leader in Iran, in the Iranian system. The Iranian leadership has repeatedly expressed its belief that it is carrying out divine will, as it defines it. Obviously, others differ as to what the Quran says, but they believe they're carrying out divine will, their interpretation, which has precedence over international law made by men. And the Iranian leadership are, in fact, very skeptical of law made by men, including international law, democratic law, et cetera, et cetera. The supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has explained, for example, his antipathy to the United States as follows, quote, "The source of all human torment and suffering is the liberal democracy promoted by the West." So that's what the supreme leaders of Iran have had to say about international law. What has been their record of compliance with international law? Well, the Islamic Republic of Iran has flouted international diplomatic law since its founding in 1979 by Ayatollah Khomeini. The Islamic Republic's first major flouting of international law was the seizure in November of that year of diplomats at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which violated a fundamental tenet of international law, the inviolability of diplomatic envoys and embassies. Treaties violated by the seizure included the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations and the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. In subsequent years, and indeed decades, the Islamic Republic of Iran has made a kind of specialty of violating diplomatic law. Subsequent violations by Iran of diplomatic law included sponsorship of the 1983 Hezbollah bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, killing 63 people, its sponsorship of the 1992 Hezbollah bombing of the Israeli embassy in Argentina, killing 29, its sponsorship of the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, the 2011 plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States in Washington, D.C., just across the river at one of my favorite restaurants, Cafe Milano. was the precise locale where that was to occur. The 2011 ransacking of the British Embassy in Tehran and various attacks and attempted attacks this year on Israeli diplomats, including in India, which the Indian police attributed the attack explicitly to the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, not even bothering with a proxy that time, Azerbaijan, and also Tbilisi, Georgia. In addition, Iran has often engaged its own diplomats in activities incommensurate with their diplomatic status, including narcotic smuggling and involvement with terrorist activities. Because of their diplomatic protections, the most that host governments have been able to do in response to Iranian diplomats' crimes has mostly been to expel them back to Iran. Iran also has a record of egregious violations of its international human rights law commitments, including especially those under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which Iran is a party. Iran has in recent years, and especially since the disputed 2009 re-election of Ahmadinejad, violated numerous articles of the Covenant, including the prohibitions on torture, on discrimination on the basis of gender, religion, and also violated the rights of freedom of expression, assembly, religion, and association. In the nuclear nonproliferation arena, my specialty, Iran continues to openly and admittedly violate UN Security Council resolutions ordering Iran to suspend its nuclear enrichment, reprocessing, and heavy water-related activities, as well as violating its nuclear nonproliferation treaty commitments. In the terrorism law arena, Iran has continued its destabilizing support for terrorist groups across the Middle East in violation of various of the 14 anti-terrorist treaties that Avi Bell referenced, and also in violation of UN Security Council Resolution 1373. Iran has also, in the terrorism law arena, provided terrorist groups with arms in violations of UN Security Council Resolutions 1701 and 1747. According to the US State Department annual report on state sponsors of terrorism, Iran is the leading state sponsor of terrorist groups in the world. Finally, in the narcotics law arena, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps reportedly is heavily engaged in narcotics smuggling to the West in violation of the UN Convention Against Illicit Traffic in Narcotic Drugs, to which Iran is a party. Despite its illegality, the IRGC uses narcotics trafficking as a significant source of revenue, justifying its engagement in this activity on the grounds that it furthers Iran's goal of undermining the West. As one IRGC officer put it, "We were told drugs would screw up the sons and daughters of the West. We should kill them. Their lives are worth less because they are not Muslims." Now, what characterizes Iran's violations of international law? Other than the sheer frequency and variety, I think it's interesting to note Iran's extensive use of proxies. For example, in most of the embassy attack cases, the Iranian government has used proxies such as Hezbollah or quote-unquote Iranian students. This could be seen as an Iranian nod to international law, somewhat like the tribute that vice pays to virtue. But I think the idea there would be, well, you know, Iran must take international law a little bit seriously, because if you don't care at all about being seen as violating international law, you violate it yourself. However, I think there's a somewhat more sophisticated reason for Iran's extensive use of proxies. International law has an exceptionally high threshold for when a forceful response against a state sponsor of a non-state armed group is justified. The international community's short attention span means that by the time Western governments are able to prove, using publicly available or declassifiable information, that Iran was behind the attack, the pressure to retaliate against Iran, and certainly the support for doing so, has lessened. For example, July 1987, 4 years after the Marine Barracks bombing in Beirut, Iran's then Minister of Revolutionary Guards, Mohsen Rafik Dost, admitted that, quote, "both the TNT and the ideology, which in one blast sent to hell 400 officers, NCOs, and soldiers at the Marine headquarters, were provided by Iran." This was the Minister for Revolutionary Guards, admitted it. But was even President Reagan going to order a military strike against Iran for an attack 4 years later? He did not. By then, everybody had moved on. Indeed, the Iran-Contra scandal had broken. The last thing the president was going to do was to compound the embarrassment by drawing attention to Rafik Dost's admission. So the difficulty in expeditiously proving that a particular attack by one of its proxies was ordered by Iran enables Iran to act through its surrogates with impunity in exploitation of the rule of law. Now, what can be done about Iran's repeated flouting of international law? For about the first three decades since the 1979 Iranian Revolution, Iran was hardly ever held accountable for its violations. I wrote a scholarly article about this and found an astonishing record of failure to hold Iran accountable for its violations. This impunity, I would argue, emboldened Iran. Only within the last few years, and really only in the nuclear arena, in which Iran is admittedly violating international law, has Iran been made to pay a heavy price for its violations. The economic sanctions on Iran have clearly had a strong impact on the Iranian economy. However, they've so far failed to achieve their intended objective of inducing the supreme leader to agree to halt his nuclear weapons program. Now, an Iranian nuclear arsenal, should Iran achieve one, would serve Iran as a nuclear umbrella, making countries victimized by Iranian-sponsored terrorism or other violations of international law even more reluctant to retaliate against Iran. This would likely make Iran an even more self-confident supporter of terrorism and violator of other international laws. In light of Iran's record of flouting international law without a nuclear umbrella, the idea of a nuclear-armed Iran is a frightening one indeed. President Obama has said it would be unacceptable for Iran to have a nuclear weapon. In his September 25th speech to the UN General Assembly, Obama stated that, quote, "The United States will do what we must to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon." Thank you very much.
Thank you for your attention. The project I'm going to discuss and present is a work in progress, an ongoing research effort by my former student Dana Bruska and I. And I will be presenting some preliminary findings. And the topic is settlements in violation of international law, a topic that is much in the news and frequently discussed. The settlements that we will be discussing are ones which, however, are not so much in the news. So, what is a settlement in international law? Really, as a matter of international law, it's a misnomer. There is no such word or concept as settlement in international law. But there is Article 49, subsection 6 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Geneva Conventions are a series of treaties governing armed forces in hostilities and subsequent occupation. The Fourth Geneva Convention relates to the treatment of civilians. And it's a very long treaty, says a ton of things. Article 49, in particular, is about demographic changes by the occupying power in occupied territory. And Articles 49, 1 through 5 generally deal with kicking out or moving around the people in the occupied territory, deporting them, expelling them, etc. Article 49, 6, in particular, is a bit different, and it does not deal with anything done to the occupied people per se. Rather, it deals with nationals of the occupying country, and it prohibits the occupying power from, quote, deporting or transferring. So the occupying power shall not deport or transfer its civilian population into the occupied territory. Israel's presence in the West Bank is regarded by much of the international community as an occupation. Whether that is the case is debatable. It depends on whether one thinks the Geneva Convention applies to this conflict, and Israel maintains it doesn't. But the civilian Jewish presence in the West Bank is regarded by much of the international community as, almost all, I would say, as a violation of Article 49.6. And thus, when you hear this discussed in the news, Israeli settlements are inevitably described as which the entire international community regards as illegal. Now, 49.6 is an obscure provision. There's not much history, background, as to what it was supposed to accomplish. And on its face, there are a couple questions that arise about 49.6 that must be asked. in relation to Israel, and in general as to the meaning. So the first question is, deport or transfer? It says, the occupying power shall not deport or transfer. Now, Israeli settlers are in the West Bank generally willingly, civilians who have bought houses and moved there of their own accord. So the first question is, what's deport or transfer mean? What does it mean for the occupying power to deport or transfer? Does it involve voluntary movement of people? And so forth. Second question is, let's say that you have a violation of Article 49.6. What's the remedy? What's the solution? What are you supposed to do with these people? In its advisory opinion on the Israeli separation wall in 2005, the International Court of Justice, this is a non-binding opinion, answered both questions. They said deport or transfer means basically allow or maybe facilitate, but it involves clearly voluntary movement, purely voluntary movement of civilians, and anything which the government in any way gives some kind of nod to. In other words, indirect deportation or transfer, even if it basically looks like the voluntary movement of civilian people. In other words, the government doesn't really have to do anything to violate 49.6 if it permits civilians to migrate. And what is the remedy? The remedy is they have to be kicked out. So the question is, where does it get these interpretations? So there is not any background on the meaning of this provision. How do you normally construe treaty language in international law? Generally by looking to see how it has been interpreted in other contexts. And in international law, precedent, called state practice, is what takes the place of court cases in normal law. How countries interpret international law in particular context helps us understand what international law really means. It's the interpretation countries put on international law that actually defines it. Now, how has 49.6 been interpreted in other contexts? Well, the question, it turns out, is a little bit hard to answer because traditional academic sources do not discuss 49.6 in any other context. So if you do a search of legal articles on electronic databases to look at the discussion of 49.6 violations by any other country, you will find no articles addressing 49.6 violations anywhere else, potential 49.6 violations. And there's a document, a very useful document, prepared by the International Committee of the Red Cross, which has appointed itself and is widely regarded as an authoritative interpreter slash custodian of the Geneva Conventions. It compiles an index, a guidebook to state practice under the Geneva Conventions, ways that the countries have interpreted and applied the Geneva Conventions. And it has a very long entry on 49.6, all of it referring exclusively to how 49.6 has been interpreted in the context of Israel. So if you ask, how do you know that 49.6 means Israeli settlements are illegal? The answer is, well, we've decided in the context of Israel that that's what it means. So that would be a completely normal thing to do if there were no other examples of actions that violate 49.6. Then if you only have one data point, then you have to decide there. It turns out that there are a significant number of other actions which quite squarely raise 49.6 issues. And many of them occur in the Middle East and actually simultaneous with, synchronous with the Israeli settlement movement. And I will mention a few of them and discuss the international reaction, and in particular how these questions of voluntary movement, government action, and remedy, what to do, were resolved in these contexts. And these contexts briefly are Western Sahara, Moroccan settlers in Western Sahara, Indonesian, Balinese settlers in Eastern Timor, and Turkish settlers in Northern Cyprus. Okay, so Western Sahara was conquered by Morocco in 1975. This was an action that was condemned by the Security Council. And in 1976, Morocco explicitly adopts a Moroccanization policy of Western Sahara. It spends $2.4 billion building infrastructure, roads, and what would be called settlements, subsidizes the salaries and movement of settlers, builds entire towns for them, and as a result, 170,000 Moroccan nationals move into Western Sahara, territory occupied by Morocco. Now, it's not clear how many indigenous People had been in Western Sahara before. The census is very unreliable. But as a result of the Moroccanization process, the Moroccan population, Moroccan national population of Western Sahara is more than half, 55% by some estimates, and 66% by many other estimates. So this seems to be the kind of, and this was organized explicitly by Morocco. There was really no other way it could happen because the distances across the desert are a little bit daunting for individual efforts. And so they organized these buses much as they had organized the original 350,000 person Green March by which Western Sahara was conquered. Okay, so what to do? First of all, does this constitute a settlement? Does this constitute a violation of 49.6 in the eyes of the world? Apparently, even though Morocco greatly facilitated this, this does not amount to significant enough government action to constitute deportation or settlement. And we can conclude that from the fact that no international agency, organization, or country ever said that this is a violation of 49.6. I don't mean Security Council resolutions, I mean no one ever called this a violation of 49.6, which can lead, which in international law, the way international law works, it's a little funny. You don't say, ah, that means they just didn't care or were biased or whatever. You say, ah, that means that that's not what 49.6 means, because the meaning of the state practice defines the meaning of the ambiguous provision. Now, there have been internationally backed, UN-backed peace plans for Morocco, for Western Sahara, which specifically deal with the status of these settlers. Now, they were not called settlers in violation of 49.6, but everyone understood that they were there, and something needs to be done with them. In the second Baker peace plan, suggested by Secretary of State James Baker, endorsed by the United Nations, all of the settlers would be entitled to stay, and anyone who had been there since for the past 4 years, before the peace deal went into effect, would actually be allowed to vote in a referendum on the future political status of Western Sahara, which, since the settlers clearly constitute a majority, an absolute majority, would actually be decisive of the future. So the settlers are not only allowed to stay, they are allowed to determine the political future of the entity. East Timor. Interestingly enough, all these examples I talk about started within a year of each other. East Timor, 1975. Conquered by Indonesia upon the Portuguese withdrawal. It was supposed to be an independent state, was the idea when the Portuguese withdrew. Indonesia conquers it. The Security Council, unlike with Morocco, the Security Council does not condemn, but there were General Assembly resolutions condemning it every year for 8 years. Then they kind of lost interest. Indonesia adopted a policy of transmigration into East Timor. This was not a new policy. Indonesia was is a huge multi-island empire, and they had a previous policy of transmigration within Indonesia to encourage Balinese to settle on other islands with different ethnicities. But here, the policy was extended to East Timor, and tribes were invited by government resettlement programs. They were brought by the government. They were trained in agricultural methods that would be effective, modern agricultural methods, and organized and sent by tribe or by village to new areas where they were settled in separate Balinese villages outside of the Timorian villages. This was a voluntary program, like Israeli settlers, but highly, highly centralized because, again, this was the only way you could really move agricultural, agrarian peasants to new islands and new farming communities, and they were given free land in these places, much like the Moroccan settlers. How many people went? Nobody really knows. So in Israel, we have the great advantage of groups like Peace Now, which document every single house and every single civilian Jew who moves to the West Bank. They do not have Peace Now, apparently, in East Timor, and so the numbers of Indonesian settlers are estimated from 15,000 to 160,000, which is a big range and shows that nobody was counting very carefully. Nobody accuses Indonesia of a violation of Article 49.6, again suggesting that even centrally organized resettlement does not count as a violation of deportation or transfer. It gets even funnier. The transmigration program, in general, was actually funded by the World Bank. And some of this resettlement received explicit international support. The UN-backed peace plan in 1999 called for East Timorian independence, in which the majority of Indonesian settlers would again receive citizenship, stay, and actually be allowed to vote in the referendum on independence, in which they did vote for independence in this case. Finally, Northern Cyprus, again, 1974, Turkey invades. 160,000 to 170,000 settlers have come from Turkey. Again, some actively encouraged by the government, others just go because there's business and cheap things there. They will soon be, if they are not already, an absolute majority of northern Cyprus. There's some census questions. UN-backed peace plan allows the vast majority of these settlers to stay. There have been several iterations because how many settlers are allowed to stay is a bit controversial, and it's also controversial how many there are, but it seems the majority would be allowed to stay, and certainly anyone born there or who had been there for the past many years would be allowed to stay in the UN peace plans, which have been rejected. Let me just conclude, these are not the only examples. There are some other examples which we hope to look into. Azerbaijan has accused Armenia of settlement in the areas around Nagorno-Karabakh that Armenia secured in its successful long war, the Nagorno-Karabakh War. Russia has, it seems, those sources are also a bit obscure, been encouraging settlement in Abkhazia, which occupied Georgian-occupied territory. And Vietnam settled something like 300,000 people in Cambodia who, in the peace plan, were allowed to stay because of their past ethnic associations with Cambodia and so forth. So there's a lot to look into. Unfortunately, we don't have peace now in all these countries, and it's very hard, data-intensive work to find this information. What we can briefly conclude in short is it seems anything other than some kind of forcible movement has not been called deportation or transfer by the international community, and the remedy for deportation or transfer, if these things were deportation or transfer but no one chose to call them such, does not involve the forcible removal of the transferred civilians.
Thank you, Eugene. I think we've had a number of very interesting presentations, and thanks to all of you. I hope you'll join me in thanking my fellow panelists for an interesting presentation.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To become an ASMEA member or to learn more about ASMEA, please visit us online at asmeascholars.org. That's ASMEA scholars.org.